I get this, well, Jeff sent me an email. He asked me about this sous vide thing that I was talking about, I think it was last week. And so Jeff sends me an email. He says, now that this sous vide thing has won me over, and it's like big time, dude. Let me tell you, that's a really incredible way to cook. But anyway, he says, do you think that you can use it to maintain accurate high-level fermentation temps? And I think this is probably centered around the email that Ryan had sent out today, too, stating that Ricky had released his recipes. And, of course, I mean, you know, all his recipes, you look on them, it says ferment at 82 degrees. So I was thinking, and I emailed him back, and I told him, well, you know, I don't see why it wouldn't. If you put it in a tub of water and put your, you know, fermentation vessel in that tub of water and maintain that heat. A couple of drawbacks, though. One I didn't tell you about, though, Jeff, that concerns me. But the first one, of course, is these sous vide machines. They're like 1,000 watts, so it's like running a hairdryer 24/7 for like, you know, 10 days. So, I you know, I mean, how fast do you want to make your meter spin? The other thing, I don't know. Now, mind you, they keep a very accurate temperature. Okay, I've noticed that the one that I have, which is a Nova, within a half a degree. I mean, it keeps it within the current temperature, the correct temperature. But, you know, fermentation temperatures are not the same as your ambient temperatures that you're trying to control. So we all know that fermentation creates heat inside the vessel. And sometimes it's been known, at least from what I've read, to vary sometimes 10 degrees. So I don't know. I suppose if you were to guess, I don't know. Help me out with this. I mean, what do you think, Jeff?
Well, it's possible. I mean, and the variance in fermentation temperature inside versus outside, it really does depend on the size of the vessel. From what I am given to understand, just because water is such an efficient transmitter of temperature, you really only start to notice a difference when you're talking about fermenters over about 10 to 15 gallons, and even then it's a minor one. The point where that's really, you know, cooking up is when you scale to much larger fermenters where you're talking about 2 or 3 feet of liquid between the outside edge and the inside of the middle of the fermenter.
Yeah. Well, then so, I suppose on a small scale, you know, you may not be talking about, you know, too much variation. But like I said, how fast do you want your, you know, electric meter to spin for the next, you know? That's the only big drawback. I mean, like I say, I mean, some of these things, like the particular one that I have is 900 watts. Mm-hmm. Not as bad as a hairdryer, but some of these things go way up there. You know, you get into some of the industrial type that you can actually buy, consumers can buy, and they're up into several thousand watts. But interesting concept for sure. Another use for one of these immersion cooking devices. Hey, welcome to the Mead House. You know, you can get the show on TuneIn Radio live. I don't know that I keep forgetting to mention that. If you can't get to or you're out somewhere, you can get the TuneIn Radio app and take the show with you. If you're mobile or if you're sitting in front of your computer, certainly go to themeadhouse.com. But another option is TuneIn Radio, TuneIn.com. The Facebook, the Mead House, everybody who's listening to the show tonight, I'm sure has listened before. So, you know, all the usual, links. We live at themeadhouse.com. I haven't looked at the calendar. I don't know where we're at. I know we're probably getting down pretty close to the wire since we came back from Christmas holiday. We are on a 6-2 schedule, so I think we got a couple more shows, and then we're going to be off for 2 weeks, back on February 28th. The call-in number for the show, 818-921-4680. We'd be glad to hear from you. But let's do this. Ryan Richardson in the house tonight. Aaron Martin, he's off tonight. Aaron, if you're listening, hope you feel better. I know Jeff made mention that his family a little under the weather tonight as we get the show rolling. Mississippi, Chris Spencer in the house. And, of course, my name is J.D. Webb. Jeff, what did you find on Facebook this week?
Oh, I've got a few shout-outs to make here. Michael Mayer on Mead Makers had his, speaking of temperature control and stuff like that, was showing off a little – temp control unit that he'd made for his ferment stuff with just one of the STC-1000's little project box and an outlet. Glad to see you're taking that seriously. You're making that step to get accurate temperature control. And I hope that serves you well, Michael. There was James Tiemann on Mead Makers as well. He got looks like he had a little bit of a project going on. He got some Spanish demijohns, which are they're like a carboy, only a little bit rounder. And he made these really nice looking, wooden carry case, kind of a crate looking thing for him with a really sharp little, honeycomb and, bee design on them that I thought was really nice. And then, just an interesting approach to degassing from Travis Brandt on, the mead board. He was actually using an immersion blender to degas his blackcurrant mead. Not something I'd thought of. I'm a little bit, worry about with all the moving parts, just getting stuff caught in there and the potential for infection. But you know, if you could keep it sanitized, I would think that would be a great way to degas pretty quickly.
Yeah, those immersion blenders are like turbine powered. They're like, wow.
Yeah, he's saying he's using it on a 30-liter Speedle, which is around about 7 gallons. And says he just gets it in the top, and he's got a whirlpool all the way top to bottom.
Oh, I'm sure. You know, and that much liquid, it might work. If it's one of these little, I've got an immersion blender here. I mean, if it's one of these little household jobs, I might even give that a shot. So, good deal. Anything else, Jeff?
That was what I saw.
Good deal. Well, tonight, I'm still drinking beer. I'm on this quest like Mississippi was here a while back. I've been drinking beer. I'm trying all these stouts and porters and stuff. And of course the orange thing that I got going tonight, I'm drinking, this is from Ninkasi Brewing Company in Eugene, Oregon. And this is a vanilla, it's called a Vanilla Otis, Vanilla Otis. It's an oatmeal stout. I don't know that I get, I'm not sure what the oatmeal is supposed to do. Just by the label, I was expecting maybe some kind of an oatmeal taste, but there really isn't any. So I don't know what the contribution there is. What's that?
Mouthfeel. That's what the oatmeal is in there for.
Okay, yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, I'll buy that. It does have a kind of almost a chewy, kind of a thick, kind of a mouthfeel to it. Just a hint of vanilla, not a whole lot. It's okay. I don't know that I would buy it again, but it's certainly worthy of giving it a shot. I mean, I walked down the aisles at BevMo and Total Wine and, you know, one that I haven't seen, I'll grab it off the shelf, throw it in the cart, and, you know, let's give this one a shot. So that's what I'm drinking tonight. Jeff, would you pour in your glass?
Well, you know, I was at the liquor store earlier today and was, the weather is a little bit odd here. It's fighting between early spring and the ends of winter. And it's cold enough that I wanted something really full bodied, but, it's not cold enough that I wanted to pour a stout or a porter. So what I settled on was a Golden Belgium, really nice full bodied. It's from, it's North Coast Brewery and it's Prankster with a Q.
instead of a K.
Really full bodied, nice flavor to it. Malty, but with a little bit of hint of hops, so going down really good.
Sounds good. Mississippi, what'd you pour tonight?
Well, it's been a little over 70 degrees here today, and so
regular heat wave, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's been warm for January, and so I'm kind of like Jeff. I didn't want anything too heavy, so I decided to go with dark roast coffee, and yeah.
Okay.
That's about it.
And I won't.
No, I just got home from the gym doing cardio, and I just didn't feel like that alcohol was the thing to top that off. So I might later on.
So you'll down a whole cup of coffee and keep your heart rate going then, huh?
Yeah, keep it up. Keep the thermogenics going, and maybe a beer before bed or something.
Well, you know, you being a doctor and all, I know this is off the subject. I mean, this is like way off the subject, but I did read, I don't remember where it was, one of the news pages I was on, that there's a few people out there that are now saying that caffeine may actually be good for the heart. So
did you happen to read my paper that I got published last week?
No.
Did I send you the link to it? I'll have to send you the link to it. Yeah, the American Journal of Medicine posted an article that I wrote on the thermogenic effects of coffee.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Send me the link. I'll have to read it.
I may not know exactly what I'm talking about, but it sounded good. Anyway.
Sounded good.
Yeah. You would swear I knew what I meant when I wrote it.
Isn't that what counts?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Hey, Ryan, between all this, what are you drinking tonight?
I am drinking a Braggot tonight. A local one here out of just outside of Minneapolis. This is a IPA Braggot. Loads of hops. It had 600 pounds of local wildflower honey in the tank, and it was dry hopped with 7 pounds of aroma hops per barrel.
Wow.
So it is very good. It's very tasty. I'm getting tons and tons of hops. The honey is not coming through super strong, just because I'm getting overwhelmed by these hops, these in a good way. And this is, I mean, fresh. This was bottled, less half a week ago. I think just 4 or 5 days ago. So, you know, those hops deteriorate rather quickly. So that's why I wanted to drink this guy and get it when it was the way it was intended to be.
Now, how did you know you bought it? You got it at a liquor store, you say?
No, this was a special release. They only bottled 1,200 bottles. Mm. They had a release party at the brewery. They only had 700 bottles at the brewery. They bottled them up on, I think, a Friday, Thursday and Friday. They started bottling them up, and Saturday morning was the release. And that was all she wrote. They were gone as soon as the doors opened. They still had it in kegs in the tap room and that kind of thing. And the tops, so the tops of the bottles were dipped in wax, which was beeswax from the same apiary where the honey came from.
Oh, cool. Cool. You know, Braggot is not a very well known, if at all, style out there that I'll tell you, I go to BevMo and Total Wine, and I ask the guys there, you know, can you point me in the direction of, a nice Braggot? And, looks like we lost, Jeff. work on getting Jeff back here. But anyway, so I asked these guys, you know, can you point me in the direction of a nice braggot? And they don't have a clue what I'm talking about until I explain it to them. They still don't. So it's not a real well-known style out there at all. Trying to find a braggot at, you know, my BevMo and Total Wine is like, you know, asking the guys if there's, you know, if they can point me in the direction of plumbing tape. They have no idea what I'm talking about. So, you know, it'd be nice for some of these breweries, you know, to start putting the stuff out on the shelf, a little more.
Well, and anyway, to be fair, I mean, braggots are hard to make as far as legality goes. In a lot of states,
right.
You can make mead on a winery license. You can make beer on a brewery license. You can't make a braggot because it's not one or the other. It's both.
Right. And, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So that's,
and like,
that's,
I think Michael Fairbrother mentioned that he was left to blend. That was his only option.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, though. Well, let's keep the show moving here. We were going to get started talking about piments. And I kind of pointed this over to Ryan's direction because he's talked about it before. Ryan, you and I have had a couple of discussions about piments and about grape juice and about using, juice from these wine kits or versus using juice from these concentrates like Alexander's and what have you. But first, let's get started on exactly what is a piment. And I'm going to turn it over to Ryan.
Well, piment, at its most basic, is mead fermented with grape juice. Now, I think in the same way that you can have a much fuller debate or conversation about what constitutes a braggot, it's in the same way of a piment. And the example here is, tonight I'm drinking a braggot. The brewery calls what they put out a braggot. It does not contain 51% or more of its fermentable sugar from honey. It is predominantly a malt-based beverage. And so I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, it's a honey beer. I think, Jeff, you might have mentioned, you know, some of those distinctions a few times of you know, what some of the clinical definitions might be of a braggot in that way. I take the more liberal definition of what is a piment and a braggot, just meaning that if it is, if there is a significant, and I make up your own definition of significant, amount of honey, that it would involve, that you could then make it a piment or a braggot. You know, we've talked a lot about braggots, and I hope that we have the same kind of conversation about piments now. You know, we talked about wine kits. We talked about wine juice concentrates. There are three main ways, I'll say even four, that I have to buy grape juice. And I'm sure a lot of people probably have similar ways that they can do it. Three of them originate from the homebrew shop, and one would be from the grocery store. The first three at the homebrew shop are wine kits. Now, keep in mind, wine kits usually have yields of about 6 gallons. They're bigger than the traditional 5 gallon yields that you get on a beer, which are typically all set to go. So it contains the juice, the yeast, the nutrient, you know, the bentonite, usually everything you need ready to go. There are cans of concentrated wine grape juice, such as Alexander's, which have several varieties of red, white, and blush, you know, Zinfandel, Cabernet, Gewurztraminer, et cetera. And then a few times a year on the South American and North American harvests, the homebrew shop will do a pre-order for actual fresh juice. So there was a few months back, maybe even more than a few months now, was the Chilean harvest. And so you could pre-order this fresh Chilean grape juice, I guess as fresh as you can get from Chile, coming up on a truck or however it's sent up, has not been concentrated, in any way. And then the fourth way, would be the supermarket way, would be to buy a grape juice or a grape juice concentrate from your grocery store, the same way you might do a cider or an apple juice. There you're probably talking about Concord grapes, so you want to be pretty careful in what you're getting there. I have done a couple of piments, and I have not had any ready to drink. I had one that I would be drinking right now if the carboy didn't explode and end up.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that
six,
one.
Six yeah. gallons of six God, gallons yeah. of must on the floor, which is still a little painful to talk about. I was texting JD when that happened. I think that was back around August or September when that happened. Yeah. But I've got two piments right now in carboys, and both of them are from the grape juice concentrates. Now, I prefer buying grape juice, the grape juice concentrate, being able to control the amount of juice that I'm using, the type of juice that I'm using, the strength that I'm using it in, and then adding in the amount of honey that I want. I've heard of people who have made beautiful piments using wine kits. And a lot of times what they say is they actually break those off into a 5 gallon and a 3 gallon. Again, a wine kit typically makes about a 6 gallon batch. And so what the folks that I have heard of that have done this is they will up the amount of honey. So they up the honey, they get a stronger must, a higher gravity must, and they break that off into a 5 gallon and a 3 gallon, and end up with 8 gallons. And typically they might try something a little more unique or out there in that 3 gallon batch, because they might keep the 5 gallon batch a little more traditional. I have two going right now. One is going to be a 5 gallon batch. I used 3 cans of the Alexander's juice. This is a white. It was a Sauvignon Blanc, a Gewurztraminer, and a Chenin Blanc. And then I put in, I think it was about 3 pounds of Montana white clover honey, which has got some really great notes to it. And it, a little bit of cinnamon, but very, very mild, and just a really wonderful honey, very light in color. And I thought that'd play well with the white. And so that one is going, that started off at about, 1090. I started that guy off at, and I intend to take that down, all the way dry. Again, I like, dry wines and dry drinks in general. The second one, it was a red. It's a red blend of red Zinfandel and Pinot Noir. And I was talking with JD, and JD, it must have been 6+ months ago, was talking about how he got this mostly mesquite honey from Trader Joe's. I think it's about 3.5-4 pounds of it, or I forget the container size. Yeah. And one night after the show, we were all talking about piments, and I hadn't made it yet. And when I heard about the flavor that these mesquite honey, or this Trader Joe mesquite honey has, I thought, I think that's gonna go well with this red, this Zinfandel Pinot Noir blend. I kind of imagine it as something that you'd pour you know, right next to your barbecue ribs, you know, and you drink your barbecue, you know, you eat your barbecue. So
why did you choose, why did you go with, I mean, you're talking almost opposite end of the spectrum when you go Zinfandel to Pinot Noir. Was there something that led you to use both of those instead of one or the other?
Yeah. Yeah, my one of my favorite red wines is a Zinfandel, and one of my one of my wife's favorite red wines is Pinot Noir, and I figure there's a lot of things that we clash on, and let's see how this ends up in the glass.
Do you have twin beds somewhere in the house?
No, not yet.
Okay.
You haven't been married long enough.
But I often wake up with a knee in the small of my back.
Well, I'm just thinking, just in case this marriage of Pinot Noir and Zinfandel doesn't work out. Anyway, continue on. Interesting. And yeah, that mesquite honey, once fermented, has this peppery, a peppery kind of a flavor to it. But yeah, go on.
I think it'll be good. So what I've done here when I've made these, and you know, I'll tell you guys, I did make a Concord Piment. I got, you know, the Concord grape juice, the fresh, raw, unfiltered stuff, and I mixed that with a wildflower honey, and I tasted it after. Oh, I don't know, 6 months, and it tasted like it still tasted like a grape juice, like a kid's grape juice,
like Kool-Aid or something.
Yeah, something like, you know, yeah, like a kiddie grape juice, and I cut it down with a traditional. So I didn't cut the strength of the alcohol or anything like that. I just cut it by adding a traditional to it, and this was I started off with 2 gallons of juice and I went into a 6 gallon carboy. So it started off, you know, with 2 gallons of juice. And then by the time it was done, it was a 6 gallon batch, which the rest of it being traditional. And I tried it after a year and it had started to come around a little bit. It still was very strong, but I could taste a little bit of potential. And I started doing a little bit of research and I found somebody said, yeah, for the first, you know, first year or so, it tastes like that grape, you know, kiddie grape juice. But then about year two, it comes around. And so I'm crossing my fingers, hoping that Concord comes around in year two to be a little more drinkable. Yeah. But if we go back to kind of the more traditional grape juices that you'd use to make a piment, I've done this the same way that I've done a lot of my meads. And actually I follow pretty much, even if you don't buy a wine kit, you can go on to, you know, wineexpert.com and you can just look at the directions, you know, how do they do it? And they recommend, you know, aerating it, you know, getting it down in your primary, getting it down below 10-10, and then, you know, getting it, or I should say, you know, degassing it regularly the way you would a regular mead, and then bringing it into a secondary when it's below 10-10, and then racking it again when it gets, you know, to about 9996 or, you know, below 99, or I mean, sorry, below 1, you know, you're in the 99s, you know, racking it again. And we had talked about this earlier, but what these wine kits do is they tell you to put the bentonite in up front. If you want to use it, they say you throw the bentonite in, it's the first thing you do. And it helps these things clear because these wine kits are intended to, get you, you know, fermenter to glass. In a couple months. I mean, some as low as 6 weeks, some are 8 weeks, some are, you know, in that maybe 3 months.
Yeah, don't believe everything you read on those things either.
Yeah, well, where I was going with that is that I plan on letting these things come around. I'm drinking this Braggot right now, and I mean, I get a little bit of honey out of the nose, but I don't taste a lot of honey. Now, I'm also talking about a Braggot that's got 4 ounces of hops per gallon, you know, thrown on top of it at the end of it. But
yeah, what's the ABV on that, Ryan?
6.8. I guess where I'm going with this, with the bentonite thing, is that I don't plan on drinking this. I plan on going at least 6 months, if not more, with it. And I plan on doing, you know, 6+ months in the carboy, or, you know, in that, you know, after at least 1 or 2 rackings in the carboy. And so I don't really care. It's going to settle out on its own. If it's been degassed, if it's not holding a lot of carbonic acid, you know, if you've gotten all that CO2 out, over 6 months, you know, it's going to naturally clear if you've done your job in degassing. So I didn't add any bentonite to these guys. I'm kind of letting them go. And if for whatever reason, you know, which can't be user error, but if for whatever reason they don't clear, they have trouble clearing, you know, then I'll add something on the back end. But I got a feeling that these are going to clear just fine on their own without bentonite or anything else. Where I was saying a minute ago was that I plan on aging them 6 months is not just to let the wine come around, but also to let that honey come back a little bit and bring back a little bit of that honey aroma or honey flavor and aroma that disappears, you know, shortly after you go dry, totally dry, but then tends to come back, you know, a little bit later. Now, Ricky might disagree with me. If we had Ricky on, Ricky might say, oh, you dump in 6 pounds of yeast nutrient, you know, you let it go at 112 degrees and you're ready to drink it in 6 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're only being slightly hyperbolic.
Hey, Scott Monroe's out there listening to the show, and he sent me a message on Facebook here on the Meat House. Says he made a piment twice from Welch's 100% grape juice. Says he tasted like alcoholic grape juice would not. So there you go. Well, yeah, interesting.
We've got a grape that grows wild here in the South called muscadines. I'm sure you've all heard of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the best piments I've ever tasted was a muscadine piment. Now, I will say this. I heard Ken Schramm giving a talk about piments, and I have to agree with everything he said. Most of the piments that you get commercially are not as good as what you can make at home. He said he had yet to taste what he considered to be the ideal commercially made piment. I don't know what the BJCP says about, I don't know if they have any guidelines as far as, you know, it has to be 51% honey for the fermentables or what it says. But Ken said that his opinion on this was that piment started because of low sugar grapes, and they simply used the honey to chaptalize the grapes up to whatever sugar content they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that made a lot of sense to me. That seemed like the logical thing. And so in that case, you know, historically, piments could have been variable to a great degree in how much honey they contained. So that's a whole nother discussion, I guess, but, you know, do you let the honey shine, or is this where you let the grapes shine?
I think
for the purpose of what we're doing in our show, we're not doing – I mean, I'm certainly not making anything that's going to be submitted to a competition. I don't make meads and beers and whatnot for competition. And I think that's the only area where it would really get specific on the amount of honey versus the amount of whatever, you know, else. And I don't know, we may have had this discussion before. I don't know, but I mean, even when it comes to braggots, I mean, when you look at the BJCP rule book and it says 51%, I think it is, Jeff.
I'm looking at the BJCP right now, and it does not specify that it needs to be majority honey. It doesn't mention at all what it. And to your point, Chris and JD, what you guys are talking about, this is from the style guidelines. It says there should be an appealing blend of fruit and honey character, but not necessarily an even balance. And to me, and so they're giving you as much latitude as you want there. I mean, I take that as you could. You know, you could have a very, it could go one, the pendulum could swing one way or the other. When I'm making the pie mitts I want, I want it to be very close to a wine. I mean, I want it to be wine style. I want you to be able to say, yes, I could drink this in place of a wine. But at the same time, I'm not trying to hide the honey. I don't want you to think, oh, this is just a run-of-the-mill, you know, Zinfandel or Cabernet. I want you to taste a little bit that I want the honey to contribute and be there that you notice it.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I mean, that's the whole interject. Point. Yeah, this is where the modern, you know, the modern brewing kind of diverges from historical brewing. I think like Chris was saying, the historical fact was you would get a combination of grapes and honey because people wanted to get drunk, and you put pretty much everything you had in that was fermentable sugars into a crock, and you brewed it, and that was good. You kind of just worked with what you had, and if what you had was a combination of grapes and honey, well, you're making a pie mitt. And the modern brewer tends to combine these, what we think of as disparate categories like mead or beer or wine or cider, in an artful way so that you're getting the characteristics you like of one and the other together. And it's a kind of an artful symmetry between the two. And I think that's the distinction. In modern times, we're looking for that artful combination of two nice things.
And Chris, I got a source. I got a source for your muscadines down there. Scott's telling me that he grows muscadines on the farm down there in Corinth. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can go out in the woods almost anywhere, and at the right time of year, you can get them. But you have to get them out of the trees because the deer, they will eat all the ones up, you know, just above your head level. So you take some sticks with you and you just throw them up in the trees and they rain down, and you can usually get more than you can carry pretty quickly.
We dropped, looks like, hope this doesn't happen again. We just lost Jeff. Keep going, guys. Okay, now he's back. Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem. Go ahead. Keep going, Chris.
No, I was just saying they're easy to collect, and there's a lot of people who do grow them. But if you want to take a short walk out into the woods, just about anywhere, you can find muscadines growing everywhere, and they will take over a tree to the point where they will kill the tree because there's so many vines growing up it, and you don't have to go far to find them. But they're huge. They're real big grapes. They're just wild grapes, really, was I always thought. But people started growing them, and they make a good pie mitt. They're not really like Concords, though. They have some of the same characteristics, but they don't have that, I guess you might say, that kindergarten juice type.
Their
Concords have.
No, it's completely different. And in fact, when we were on our trip in North Carolina, we stopped by the Duplin Winery there. And we picked up a whole bunch of wine and brought. In fact, we get wines from them. We join their wine of the month club. My wife loves their wines, and she gives it away to her friends. So we get a quarter, every quarter they ship us, I think, six bottles or something like that. But much different than your traditional California wines, French wines. They're very sweet. And the sweetness ranges too. Some are a little more on the dry side, but still sweet. Some are very sweet. There's red ones, there's white ones, and of course some are, I think, done with different styles of or different kinds of yeast to lend to different properties as well. So much different. I mean, the stuff that we had tasted on our first trip out there was, it's not, you're right, it's not like drinking like a kid's drink Kool-Aid type stuff, but it is a completely different kind of wine if you've never had one before, that's for sure. But Ryan, getting back to this Pyman thing, and I'm kind of stuck in between because I can actually get the pure juice from one of the homebrew shops that the guy that actually owns the homebrew shop, one of them, is also owns a winery up the coast. And he has a program where you can buy into a certain tonnage of grapes. And, you know, I think the minimum is 200 pounds. And I think it yields something like 3 or 4 5-gallon carboys or something to that effect. But anyway. So you can buy the actual juice. They ship the grapes down. You go there, you crush them, the whole nine yards. Or he also sells the concentrate, and then on top of that also has these wine kits. So, you know, I know I can't buy – if I wanted to do just a 5-gallon batch of Pyman, I mean, I don't need 5 gallons of grape juice, so I can't get into this – using the real stuff. So what is the biggest drawback, do you think, in using these concentrates? I mean, is there really going to be a discernible difference in flavors in the end?
Well, I've tasted wines that have been produced from the concentrated juice in cans, so like the Alexander's. And then I've also had wines that have been produced from the kits, such as Wine Expert.
Yeah.
The biggest difference that I notice is in the quality of the wine kit. And the very high quality wine kits, the difference is the amount of concentration that the juice goes down to. So if you look at, if you go to the home brew shop and you look at the cheap wine kits that might be, you know, $40 or I don't know, whatever the cheapest one is, it's a very small box. And it's a very small box and it's got the concentrated wine juice in it. And it says, hey, this will produce 6 gallons of wine. And then you go to the other, you know, end of the aisle, and they've got the wine kits that are $150 a wine kit.
Or more, yeah.
They're very big boxes, and they still say that they produce 6 gallons of wine. Well, the reason the boxes are bigger and the reason they're more expensive is the juice has been concentrated down less. So there is more of this juice. It's less refined. It's less concentrated. There's more of it. By the time you follow the kit and you fill up your fermenter, the specific gravities are exactly the same. You know, if you're doing a cheap Pinot and an expensive Pinot, you know, they're both going to produce 6 gallons. They're both going to have the same starting gravity. It's just a matter of how processed, for lack of a better term, that wine juice is. Is it extremely concentrated, or is it still relatively, you know, relatively raw, so to speak? Again, here's the analogy I give you. I can't taste the difference between a $10 and a $20 bottle of wine. but I can taste the difference between a $10 and an $80 bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you're splitting hairs between, you know, should I go with the lowest level kit or should I go with the one shelf up kit? You know, should I spend 40 or 50 bucks? You know, there's probably not that big of a difference. You know, but there sure as hell is a big difference between the $40 kit and the $150 kit or the $200 kit. Like I said, I have, I've had both kinds, or both, I've had all along the spectrum of wine kits. And, to me, when I'm making my first few batches here and trying to dial in what's the combination of juices I want, what's the combination of honey I want, you know, that kind of thing. I'm the guy who said crap in, crap out, you know, and yes, I absolutely still believe that. Yeah. And I'm not advocating crap in or crap out. What I'm saying is I'm going to go to the less expensive end of the spectrum to do my experimenting. And then I'm going to work its way up. I'm also the guy who told you guys I can't follow a pancake recipe without trying to do my own thing to it, which is why I also like the Alexanders, because I can say, okay, well, I like Sauvignon Blanc and I like Chenin Blanc and I like Riesling, and I can see how this grassiness might play against this citrus fruit, and I'm going to see how these work out together and create my own combination. And again, I'm going to do that in a relatively inexpensive way. What I will say is with Alexander's, when you're just buying the can of juice, it's up to you where you want that gravity to be. You know, I mean, some people will do 2 cans for 5 gallons. Some will do 3 cans for 5 gallons. Some will do 4 cans for 5 gallons. So it is up to you with the, strength in which you want to, add this concentrate, and of course then your honey as well, to get your starting gravity where you want it and what you want to come out of it. Not to use the other analogy, but if anybody ever makes cake out of the box, you know, if you're ever going to make a quick cake, mm-hmm. or something, if you ever want to make it richer and better, you add more eggs. You know, if it calls for 2 eggs, you add 4 eggs, you know, and you get a much richer, you know, a better cake. And kind of the same thing that I've read with Alexander's is that if the standard run of the mill says add 2 cans for a 5 gallon batch, puts that third can in there, because the biggest, now with that being said, of course you're going to add your
say it again, Ryan, we just dropped you there for a minute. Say it again.
Oh, I was saying, with Alexander's, the same analogy as the eggs and the cake, right? If the recipe calls for 2 cans for 5 gallons, if that's the standard kind of go-to recipe, put a third can in there. Because the biggest knock I've heard on Alexander's, especially on some of their varietals, is that they can come out a little thin. And I don't want a thin piment or a thin wine. You know, I want it to have a little more body, a little more, you know, boldness to it. So, but then I caveated that by also saying that's going to depend on where you want the gravity to be, where you want it to finish, and how much honey you're using. I guess, you know, my wrap up on this is that, it goes back to what you like. I mean, I think, you know, I was listening to another podcast and they were talking about beer brewing, but what a wonderful phrase said was, when you start out, before you make that batch, have a mission statement of what you want to make. You know what you want to come into your, mm-hmm. know what you want to put in your glass before you start to make it. And so the same thing I would say here with these piments is, whether it's the first time you've ever done it or the you know, I should say, even if it's the first time you've ever done it, picture what you want it to be like. What kind of wine do you like, or what do you want it to be like in your glass? And then start from that. And maybe you do want something that's very thin or low alcohol. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it's creating that mission statement in your mind of what do I want to end with? And what am I learning and reading and hearing and seeing that I've got to do ahead of time before I, you know, as I'm putting this recipe together.
Yeah. I've done a number of these wine kits, and from various price ranges, from the cheap ones, now the cheapest one's been about $60, to the somewhat expensive ones, about $179. And I mean, you're definitely paying for what you get. I mean, if you're working with these wine kits, don't expect that you're going to be able to put your bottle of wine up against the $100 bottle of wine, because it's not going to work. What you're going to wind up with is something better than a good table wine, a decent table wine. I mean, some of the wines that I've made, I wouldn't share at an expensive lunch with business associates, but I would put on the table for my relatives and friends at Thanksgiving dinner. So I got to be thinking about that when I'm thinking grape juice for a piment too. I mean, I like the way you talk, Ryan, because you put it out there with no BS. It's crap in, crap out. I absolutely believe that. Absolutely. And, I mean, if you're going to make something, I think it's okay to start out small, do your experiments, start out on the lesser expensive side. At least that'll give you a direction. But don't use that for your final deal. You know, put your method, your recipe, and everything together, and then once you get it to where you think you got it, then go for it. You know, get the good ingredients, get the A list ingredients, and go for it. But
if you know, you're not going to give the 16-year-old or however 15-16-year-old who's learning how to drive the keys to a Ferrari.
No.
You know, you're going to give them the Ford Escort to learn how to drive in.
Right.
But once you learn how to drive, you might enjoy a more, precision driving machine.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an Aulus Chalmers tractor on my grandfather's ranch in Oregon for me. But in any case,
I had an AMC Gremlin.
Yeah. There you go.
I had a Ford F-150.
Oh, now you're cheating.
Well, by the time I keep
hey,
in
that's
mind,
what I got now.
By the time I got it, it was a 14-year-old F-150 when I learned how to drive on it.
There you go. Good stuff, Ryan. Now, for the second part of this, I'm going to task you with coming up with a recipe that you can share with us next week on the show, and we're going to put it up on a website and let people take a crack at it. And let's keep everything very simple. Let's go with the Alexander's. It's readily available. I think Northern Brewer. I've seen it out there all over the place.
Yep.
Let's go with Alexander's concentrates. Let's keep it to 3 gallons. And let's put a recipe together that we can throw up on the website. So spend some time putting it together, using honey that's relatively available, orange blossoms, clovers, wildflowers, that kind of thing. Nothing real exotic. And let's talk about it next week. What do you think?
That sounds great. Parting thoughts here on this. Number one is, if you go to the Northern Brewer website, and I'm being too honest here, I don't know why I'm saying this, because I could have just ripped it off and told you guys it was mine. But if you go to the Northern Brewer website, they have a section called, Meet Our Brewmasters or Meet Our, whomever. And there's a guy named Chris, I think it's Chris, and he specializes in mead. And he has his award-winning piment recipe on the website. And I will come up with another one. but he has an award-winning Piment website on the on Northern Brewers web .com that talks about it. And so again, I suppose I could have just told you guys that was the recipe and hope no one ever caught me. But then the second thing I'll tell you guys is that here's a little challenge for our audience, because I hope that when we're doing things, you know, when we're making braggots or we're making hydromels or whatever we're doing, I hope some of our audience is doing this along with us. And here's my challenge for our audience. The very impressive, and I will call him very impressive, the very impressive Pete Bakalich said that he had never had a piment that was a good representation of a mead or a wine. And that might not be his exact quotes, but he basically was saying that he goes, I've never had a piment that was wine-like, that was as good as a wine, and I've never had a piment that's, you know, mead-like, that's as good as a good mead. That maybe in competition he's right. You know, he's had a lot more mead than I have. But let's do a challenge to try to find, you know, to our unsophisticated palates, what we think is a great representation of what a piment can be.
Sure. Sounds like a plan. Good stuff, Ryan. Thanks. Coors Beer. Rocky Mountain Spring Water. I think it's been on their label, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I used to be a Coors drinker. My dad was a Coors drinker. That was, I think, the beer that he and I shared when I was 12 years old. It's in the water. It's the water. I think that was on the label of the Olympia. Now, some of you might not even be old enough to even know these brands that I'm talking about, but Olympia Brewing Company. It was all about the water. Hams, born in the land of sky blue waters, Mississippi,
Minnesota.
I believe that was on the label too. So there's got to be something about the water. There's got to be something about the water.
I don't want to hijack this, but since you mentioned Hams, I do want to say one thing. The old Hams Brewery is in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm from St. Paul. I lived in St. Paul just till a couple of years ago, when I moved 6 miles away to Minneapolis. But the old Hams Brewery, it's no longer in operation. It's being, you know, renovated as we speak. But they have a automated aquifer water, you know, spout. And you bring your own containers, and I think it's 25 or 50 cents a gallon. And you put it in, and it pulls up the same water right out of the aquifer that the Hams beer was made with.
Oh, no. You know what? Get me a little pint of it and put it in a bottle and do that. You know, I'm just going to put it on the shelf and say, this came from the Hams Brewery. A little piece of history, you know. Gosh, I'd like to have been there when they were doing the renovation to maybe walk off with a couple of souvenirs, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I mean, there, and I'm sure there's more. I only spent about 10 minutes to look today, but I thought to start off this next segment, there's three beer labels out there that, have everything to do with the water, excuse me, the water that's used to make their beer. So Coors, Olympia, and Ham. I'm sure there's more. But Chris, this is an ingredient. You know, we get so wrapped up in the peaches and the raspberries and the blackberries and the purees and even the honey and the nutrient and the yeast and all this other stuff that's going to come together to make a great tasting mead. But we seem to forget the biggest component of our batch is actually the water.
Yep. that's 75% to 95%. You know, if you're making a hydromel, you could be as high as 95% water. And when we were changing emails, I used the example that you could take a sip of distilled water and a sip of mineral water, and you can see there's a very large difference there. And then you translate that into a batch of mead that has, you know, 85% of it is water. What kind of flavor impact does that have? And then, of course, Jeff's going to bring up some other points that he pointed out about the mineral and ion content. The way, you know, unfortunately, people get bored with this because they say, well, it's just water. I imagine there's probably going to be some people who are going to hear the introduction to this and they're going to say, I don't want to listen to that. It's just water. It's the biggest component in what you're making. And, you know, I came around to this because I was working so hard on all these different beers in order to make a good braggot. And when you start studying about beer brewing, eventually you're going to come around to water chemistry. And so that's what happened to me. And in the process of doing that, I was actually sitting here formulating, starting with distilled water, how I could make the water profile I needed for the next beer I was going to make. And it just occurred to me that, you know, nobody has, I've never heard anyone apply this to mead making, and I'm guilty of it. I go to the store, I get bottled spring water, and I make my mead. And so what can we do differently? Throughout history, if you look at beer brewing and wine making, there's certain regions, certain countries that have become famous for certain wine styles because of the grapes they grow, certain beer styles, which I don't know if it's, I tend to think it's because of the water. I think that with a certain style of beer, this particular type of water was able to extract the most out of those grains, and that led to what we now is generally recognized as, you know, the ideal for that style of beer.
You sure it just wasn't the decoction mashing?
Yeah. Hey, with the decoction, you know, that Bock is the Bock is a week old today, and I told JD the other day, I said, I hope it turns out tasting like crap, because that would give me an excuse not to ever have to make it again. but because that was made with the intentions of testing it out and seeing if it would make a good braggot. But anyway, you know, it just got me thinking, why not have a discussion about water? Do we need pure water, distilled water, water that has low mineral contents in order to make the best? Let's just take a traditional mead, for instance. Or do we need something that's laden heavily with minerals and has a very minerally taste and a, you know? And then Jeff, you've got some other ideas as far as those minerals are concerned and how they may play a part.
Yeah, and definitely. Like you mentioned, there are the water profiles for a lot of different beer styles do depend on the localizations where they're from. And you know, it may not necessarily even be that they allowed for the maximum extraction. There are some I've been reading a little bit on some beer recipes where there are certain locales where mineral content in the water actually partially prevented extraction, and it had a less attenuation effect, and that left it didn't stop extraction, it stopped attenuation of the yeast, and so it left a maltier finish with a little bit more residual sweetness, as opposed to a beer where it might have ended up drier because of the mineral content of a water source elsewhere. There are a lot of different ways that your water can affect not only the raw flavor of the mead, but also it could affect the way that yeast react to it. And the classic example we've brought up already is spring water, and I think most of us either use that or tap water. The spring water has these trace minerals in it, we know, like potassium, magnesium, that we're also trying to supplement by means of fermented K or other yeast nutrients, and those probably do play a role in just creating a good mead as well.
You know, I get annoyed because I see the labels and I see these vending machines, these water machines out there. Take your 5-gallon bottle, you pay $5 or whatever the going rate is, and you stuff your bottle under there and you fill it up. And, you know, on the outside of the machine, it says something like spring water, you know. Yet, you know that the water is hooked up to the city water system, and there's nothing more than probably a charcoal, something similar to a swimming pool. Probably charcoal, sand, and maybe a ceramic filter. And you know those kinds of things have to be changed periodically because of mold and other bacteria buildup. So what are you really getting when you go to the store and buy a gallon jug of spring water? What are you really getting?
Well, I noticed that some of the spring water that I get actually lists the spring that it comes from and where it's located, and some of it doesn't. And I'm assuming that the ones that do not list a spring are probably distilled or reverse osmosis water that's been fortified with a mineral profile similar to spring water in some certain location. So, but I do know some of them list a spring.
Well,
likewise, I was just going to note, you could go on to Ozarka's website, and they have their water quality report from, I think Ozarka pulls from 3 independent springs, and it probably lists those in the bottle, but they actually have a listing of the mineral quality or mineral content averages for year by year. If you pull up their reports, it takes a little digging on their website, but you can find that pretty easily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the, I've got a jug of Kroger brand spring water is what we buy in the store. This says, Palomar Mountain, California, source, Palomar Mountain, California. I'm going to have to get a different light here. I just can't, my eyeball just can't see very well. So let me get my other light here. So this is, it really doesn't, it just says for a report on water quality and information, called, you know, this number, 1-800, whatever. So, man, that's all it says. But it just carbon filtered and I want to say ozo something or other for purity. Can't really read the writing there, but ozomated?
Ozone.
The hell that?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
Ozonated. Yeah, they treat it with ozone as a disinfectant.
Okay, so like I said, this is it's water probably coming out of a tap in Palomar Mountain facility and put through a carbon filter, charcoal basically.
Yeah, and what I was about to say is when it comes to beer brewing, water mineral content and ion content, those things primarily are important in the mash, in an all-grain mash. For pH stability and whether or not you extract tannins or not, and enzymatic activity. But when we're talking about mead, we're talking about mainly just flavor. We're talking about things like the body and mouthfeel, yeast health, as well as pH control. because if you've got a water that's got more buffering capacity or alkalinity, maybe more carbonate, a high carbonate content, then you're more likely to have a stable pH throughout fermentation.
What about distilled water? Now, I've always heard and I've read in different places that you shouldn't use distilled water.
Well, I've never used distilled water, but I'm going to make an assumption here that with all the Fermade K and Fermade O and nutrients that we add, it probably wouldn't hurt. It probably wouldn't make that much of a difference, because we're intentionally giving the yeast what they need. We're giving them those micronutrients and minerals and the zinc and the magnesium and all that stuff. But by using water that has a different flavor profile itself, in that large of a quantity, we're going to have to assume, at least it's my theory, that we're going to come up with some differences in if we made two identical batches. I may be, that's just speculation. It's nothing but a theory, but I have come up with an idea of how we could easily test this. There's a product called AccuMash, and it's basically just brewing salts. It's calcium chloride and baking soda and gypsum and, you know, Epsom salt and all these things mixed in proportions to complement certain styles of beer. So you can buy it that's engineered to treat water if you're making a pale ale or a pale that's highly hopped, or you can buy it for a darker beer that's supposed to be low hops and malty and high gravity and whatever. So my idea was to get a packet that's on opposite ends of the spectrum, get the lightest color, lowest gravity, maybe the highest bittering or lowest bittering, and then get a packet that's made for extremely dark, high gravity, malty type beers. Those are going to give you water that has very different mineral content. And start out with distilled water, so you're starting with a blank palate. You've got nothing in there but water. And make a mead with them, side by side. Keep everything else identical and everything else the same, and just see what happens.
Yeah.
I think it's worth a shot, because you just can't have something with that great of a percentage of an ingredient and ignore it. And quite honestly, I can't believe I've ignored it for as long as I have. I go to all this trouble to find the correct honey, the best fruit, the pair it with the right yeast and do everything right. And yet I've ignored the biggest ingredient of all.
The water. Yeah.
You know, when we were talking with Ricky, he had said that, you know, you can. He even recommended, I think, using distilled water because, you know, it's devoid of essentially everything. And then, you know, his recipe calls for, I think it's 4 ounces of yeast nutrient per 5-gallon batch. So mm-hmm. to your point, Chris, exactly to what you were saying, he's going, you know, you can strip everything away and have as pure of H2O as you can possibly get and then rebuild it with the nutrients that you want the yeast to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think we could do that with modern nutrients that we have. My biggest concern, though, is what would a totally different water profile, how does it affect it? Is it going to be even above the threshold to be able to taste the difference? because if you've ever had mineral water, you know that mineral water is drastically different than a spring water or a distilled water or something, just in its basic flavor. Everything about it is different. I've had mineral water that was almost, it was so rich that it almost had an oily mouthfeel to it. And I can't help but think that maybe some of the problems we have could be solved just by starting with the proper water. One of the things with a traditional mead, especially if you're making a dry traditional, is body and mouthfeel. It's just not there. And if you want to get technical about it and go by the BJCP, it doesn't have to have that as much body and mouthfeel. But what if you like that and you want to make a dry traditional? We've talked about things like adding a half a banana or adding oak or tannin or vanilla bean or something to give body. Well, what if we just need more minerals in the water to do that, or the correct ratio of minerals?
Yeah.
You know,
that's one thing.
Also, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that. I mean, that's one thing that bothers me the most about my mead making is the mouthfeel part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe it's because we're lacking in some minerals somewhere, because it's pretty obvious mineral water is a very heavy, it's heavy on the palate, just the pure water. So that's going to have to, in my theory, is going to have to carry over to the mead. So, but what we were saying earlier, that certain regions of the world have become famous for certain kinds of beers or certain kinds of wines due to their water or due to their grapes or whatever. Unfortunately, we don't have that in mead. You know, I don't know of any city that's famous for making the best semi-sweet traditional mead or anything like that. Is it because water doesn't play as big a part as I think it does? Or is it because that knowledge has been lost over time? Maybe mead making fell out of favor so long ago, and it's been out of the spotlight for so long that we just don't remember all that. But maybe there was a time when people knew that this particular water from here made the best mead or whatever. Or maybe people didn't care back then and they just wanted to get drunk and use whatever they had, you know?
Well, I mean, here's another thing to look at too. I mean, I believe that beer has been in commercial production longer than mead making has been. I mean, I absolutely believe that. So There has been, I mean, you know, I just gave you three examples, Coors, Olympia, Hams. They were obviously concerned about the water. They put it on their label. So I think there was either a science or I don't know how they arrived at it. Okay. But apparently the water was important to beer brewing back then. And we're going back turn of the century and before. Okay.
Absolutely. So, take, for example, the original golden lager, the Pilsner Urquell, the Czech word for it, Pilsenský prostroj. Prostroj, the second half of that, means spring. It's right there in the name of the beer.
Well, and you talked about in your emails, and, you know, we were going back and forth today, you know, you're talking about these Irish stouts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in the water. You know, so yeah, why would
Jeff also brought up the point that maybe they just made a lot of stouts there. Maybe it's not because that was the ideal stout, or maybe that's just what we've been led to believe because that's what's been given to us. I take the approach that it's not necessarily all about flavor. I think that if you're looking at the beer brewing aspect, I think they were looking at you know, it was all about what they had to work with. And I think a lot of this may have come up by accident, but I also think that when a particular region that has a particular kind of water hits upon some type of brew that just really works there, that's what led that area to become famous for that. And
yeah,
when you consider an entire country may be getting its grain from the same big field somewhere, roasted maybe in the same malt house or whatever, the big difference is water.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe all this is just conjecture, and it may not carry over to mead making. It may not be a perceptible difference to our taste buds. I don't know. I think it's worth looking into, though. I think it's worth at least one trial run. I'm not certain that I really want to get too in depth with it. I don't want to dig out the chemistry books and all that, but
for simplicity's sake, I mean, you know, like the water here in LA, it's not that our water is not safe to drink. It's perfectly safe to drink, but I guarantee you, when you drink it, you'll probably be able to name at least three chemicals off the top of your head, because you're going to taste them. I mean, the water, it tastes like chemicals in the water. So that's a big concern to me. I mean, the only thing we use the tap water for, well, we don't use, I use it washing dishes and, of course, doing the laundry, and that's it. We drink bottled water. I make beer, mead, and wine with bottled water. So how do you, if you live in a place like this, and maybe you don't have access to bottled water or whatever, I don't know why you wouldn't, but what do you do? What can you do to the tap water to take that chlorine chemical? I mean, some of it tastes like you just swallowed a swimming pool. Okay. How do you get around that?
Well, when I made this box, filter. That's one way. When I made this Bock, I drew up 16 gallons of tap water, and the only offending flavor or odor that our water has is chlorine. The base water is fine. I mean, if you get the chlorine out, and we've got good tasting water. So I took 16 gallons of water, dropped one Camden tablet. One Camden tablet's enough to treat 20 gallons. So for those people out there who may be allergic to sulfites, there's no need to worry there, because there's not going to be any left. Most of it's going to be taken up with the chlorine or the chloramine, and which brings up another misconception. Some people say that Camden tablets only get rid of the chloramine. No, they also get rid of the chlorine as well. They do bind with it, and they'll create sulfates and other compounds. And then any sulfite that's excess that happens to be left over, when you do your mash, if like in my case, there's going to be organic components in the grain that's going to bind up with the sulfites. And then, of course, you've got your 60-minute or 90-minute boil that you're going to do, which is going to take care of anything that's left. So you're not going to end up with sulfites in your finished product if you're doing a beer. But in a mead, if you want to get that chlorine and chloramine out of your water, draw up, 15, 16 gallons, whatever, drop a Camden tablet in it, stir it, and within 3 minutes, you got no more chlorine or chloramine. I mean, the reaction actually happens very, very quickly. It's 2 or 3 minutes and it's done.
Yeah.
So that's one way to get rid of that without having to boil it and all that kind of stuff.
Well, interesting discussion for sure. you know, like we said at the top before all the hiccups and everything we had, and I'll do all the editing to put all this together so that it makes some sense. You know, Chris was saying, you know, 75 to 90% of, you know, what you throw in your fermenter is water. So absolutely, I would think that it's going to have some kind of an impact on the final taste. And, you know, and I would tend to think that that much water, and I don't care if you're making beer or wine or mead, I would think that the quality of water is going to have an impact at some level on all of them. You know, that's just my thought, completely unscientific. But, you know, when you get down to it, you know, we just, you know, the three beer brewers that I named, they were concerned about it. I know Jack Daniels is concerned about it. You know, they talk about their water in the distillery there in Tennessee. So, you know, from distilled liquors to beer brewing to mead making to wine making, it's got to play an important part there somewhere. So,
like Ryan was saying at the top of the show, crap in, crap out. If your water doesn't taste good, your mead's not going to taste good.
Well, you know, and getting back to what Chris is talking about, the chlorine and chloramine, I mean, the water that tastes coming out of our tap, I mean, it tastes like crap. It just tastes like crap. And I wouldn't think of using it in a beer or a mead. Now, I've got one of these little Brita filter things that I, you know, it's a water container jug thing that stays in the refrigerator. And I'll run some tap water into it. And yeah, the water tastes okay. But I'm not quite that. I mean, it's not the kind of thing where you want to put 5 gallons of water through. This is a little like 2-quart thing, you know. I mean, it'd take you all day long to put enough water through it to do a batch of mead or beer or wine or whatever. So,
you know, and actually I have started using filtered tap water through the filter on my fridge for brewing, especially on the 1 gallon batches that I'm doing just for trying different things, because it is a pain in the butt to draw a whole gallon through that filter. But around here, the tap water, it already tastes pretty good. It does have some chlorine and chloramine that the filter will take care of. More important than that, though, it's also got a fairly good amount of calcium, just because we have a really, really limestone heavy bedrock in this area. And I do think the calcium in that's present from that helps with the pH buffering and preventing acid buildup in the mead as well as it ferments. So I've been pleased with my results there. I've not actually seen a big difference as far as spring water versus filtered tap water, to my mind. But, you know, it's one of those things where I've tried it and I've not noticed a huge difference, but I've also not noticed any negative difference from it either.
Yeah,
and it's important if you're going to do that to know where your water's coming from. Is it coming from a reservoir? Is it just surface water? Or is it coming from a well?
Absolutely.
From an aquifer, because you can have two people living in the same city on different sides of town, and one gets their water from a reservoir, the other gets it from a well, and it's totally different water.
Yeah. I'll tell you, the absolute best tasting water that I've ever had in my life, my dad and I were in Alaska, and we were standing on the Mendenhall Glacier. Up there, this has been a number of years ago, and there was a spring over at the edge of the glacier. The water was bubbling up, and this water was millions of years old, and it was as pure. I mean, it was the most purest water you've ever seen, and it tasted like $1 million. Unbelievable. God, it was so good. But at any rate, you know, I'm gonna leave you guys with this. This is from the Business Insider. Now, granted, this is a 2012 or 2013 article by Matthew Bosler. Americans spent $11.8 billion on bottled water in 2012. I have no clue what it is today, but holy crap. So, you know, must be something to it. You know, I guess everybody give up drinking their tap water in their kitchen.
No joke on them that so much of that is tap water.
Yeah, you know. Well, I made the comment before the show started that, you know, that on the shelf of the store where we get our water at the supermarket, my God, there are minutes of countless different, you know, Dasani, and I mean, all these different brands of just plain bottled water. And they range from, you know, like $3 to 89 cents for a bottle of water. And I'm gonna go through and pick out a bunch of them, bring them home and taste them and just see, is there really a difference between all these, you know, different brands of water? I have no clue, you know. Why does Arrowhead water cost more than the Kroger water that I have, you know? Why should that
be? It just worries me. When I turn on the tap and it smells like a swimming pool,
yeah,
it doesn't give me a good feeling because there's someone at the water department who's testing this water, and they're detecting enough pathogens to say we've got to add this level of chlorine. And
yeah,
if it's taking that much chlorine to make that suitable to drink, that's a little bit worrisome for me.
Well, that's why we all use scented soap in the shower. So I guarantee you, you take a shower here, if you don't use the scented soap, you're going to come out smelling like you just crawled out of the swimming pool. But hey, why don't we continue all this next week here at the Mead House? I think we kind of worn this one out here for tonight with all the problems we've had. So it may take me some time to get up in the morning, but by the time you hear this, it won't matter. So we'll see everybody next week.